You're listening to Grace Saves All, the podcast which exists at the spiritual intersection of Christianity and universal salvation. In this podcast, we will be exploring an ancient and modern approach to Christianity, which affirms both that grace saves alone and that grace goes to all. And now, here is David Artman, author of Grace Saves All, The Necessity of Christian Universalism.
I'm happy to welcome today to the Grace Saves All podcast, political science professor at the University of Illinois, Dr. Nicholas Grossman. He is the author of Drones and Terrorism, an editor of ARC Digital, and writes frequently about current events in a variety of outlets. Welcome, Dr. Grossman, to the Grace Saves All podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, Dr. Grossman, I want to begin our conversation with the following quote from Robert Paxton, arguably the world's leading scholar on fascism. He has now said that Trump's incitement of the invasion of the Capitol on January 6, 2020, removes my objection to the fascist label. His open encouragement of civic violence to overturn an election crosses a red line. The label now seems not just acceptable, but necessary. I was wondering how you respond to that quote from Paxton.
I think that's correct, that both January 6 itself with the attack on the Capitol was a watershed moment, that it was the moment when this movement that always had elements of anti-democratic, meaning anti-democracy, not as opposed to Democratic Party, but anti-democracy, anti-rule of law, other, I would say, arguably anti-American aspects to it, but when it spilled over into violence. And it also was a uncomfortable parallel to something from Nazi Germany, which was the beer hall putsch, which is that after Hitler had gained power politically via election and then lost some power via having an electoral setback, then he and a bunch of his followers had a haphazard violent coup attempt in which they tried to overthrow the government, and it wasn't well planned and it didn't go well. And it didn't work, but then they rallied around it and they turned the people who did it into martyrs, and they used that to help ride their way back to power. So while it is a mistake and a very common one to make, to think that fascism and the Nazis in the 1930s and 40s are the exact same thing. So if it's not exactly the Nazis, then it's not fascism. And fascism is broader than that. The Nazis are just one example. But that still did highlight the seriousness of the movement that the United States was facing. So it's not identical, but there are enough parallels for concern. And I agree that January 6th was a watershed event in that regard.
And preceding, I think, the putsch that you were talking about that happened in Germany, I think there was an election that Hitler lost by, I think, some 6 million votes. And then he said that he hadn't lost it. And then it went to the courts, and he did not, he refused to accept that he had lost that election. And then he used that as a reason to keep on moving forward, that he had an election stolen from him.
Right. So he both lied about the election and also tried to tap into an idea that some people, you know, certain type of people were effectively the real Germans, the ones who were naturally entitled to power. And so for him, the main scapegoat, not exclusive one, but main scapegoat was Jews and also Roma and homosexuals and some handicapped and others that they went after, but still had a similar idea, which we can see, again, not identical, but parallels in Trumpism, of a claim that only a certain type of people with particular beliefs, and especially often tied up with things like race and religion and other identity, are the only ones with legitimate political power. So in other words, instead of a famous political scientist line, is Adam Pajorski, about democracies, are a democracy is a political system where parties lose elections. And I always like that definition, because that's the key to it, of a party recognizes that they lost an election. And with Donald Trump rejecting really not just the 2020 results, but lying about 2016, even when he won, and claiming that there were tons of illegal votes and he should have won the popular vote, and then lying about 2020, even after investigating the fraud in 2016 and finding nothing because they were making it up, lying about 2020 and sustaining that lie for such a long time is a similar rejection of the one man, one vote, or one person, one vote principle of democracy, that each citizen is effectively equal and all have a right to it, where as opposed to in this vision that you can see with Hitler, with Trump, with Mussolini in Italy was another good example of this, that there are some people who are just the real people and therefore entitled to rule. And so any election that they lose is by definition to them illegitimate, unfair, wrong, whether they can prove that or not. And that is fundamentally anti-democracy.
Well, with regard to the big lie that Trump did not really lose the 2020 election, Reuters reported in December 24 that nationwide, a half dozen candidates who denied the 2020 election results won statewide offices, and 143 won races for U.S. House and Senate, according to data from States United Actions, and that election deniers are also filling key roles in Trump's new administration. Former Attorney General Pam Bondi she was a vocal supporter of Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 defeat, is U.S. Attorney General, and Kash Patel promoted false election fraud claims after serving Trump's first White House, and now he's head of the FBI. So the election denialism, and I also think January 6th denialism, is still alive and well.
Oh, very much so. If anything, it is thriving. It's stronger than it's ever been. So the January 6th attackers, people who were convicted in court with all due process and by a jury of their peers of crimes against the United States, some of them, quite serious things like assaulting an officer, up to conspiracy to defraud the United States and seditious conspiracy and a lot of very serious charges, convicted. And now all of them receiving presidential pardons, let out of prison. A number of them have even been rearrested because they have committed additional crimes. And while, again, I'm hesitant to overdo the parallels between now and Nazi Germany because those aren't identical, letting all of those violent criminals out of prison made me think of the black shirts in fascist Italy or the brown shirts in Nazi Germany, that the kind of street level thugs. And it also sends a strong signal to people that if you break the law to advance this political cause, if you commit crimes, including violent ones, that the president will have your back and will help you out. And that is a signal for a lot of them to encourage it. And would he actually pardon anybody who commits crimes on his behalf? Who knows? But we have never seen in the United States before a White House operate without a fear of criminal charges afterwards. Every single one before this White House, including the first Trump term, when some sort of malfeasance would come up, if somebody would suggest something that was really crossing a line, they would at least have the thought of, I could go to jail for this, that I'm obviously not going to be in power forever. This is illegal. The law applies to me. And they are not operating that way this time. And letting all the January 6th criminals out of jail is one of the clear signals that they don't need to operate that way, or Trump himself encouraging them not to.
Well, continuing some of the parallels with Hitler, I understand that in the Weimar Republic, that one of the things Hitler was so frustrated about was, there was a number of political parties. We have two political parties. I think there may be 12 or 13 that were around. So it was a chaotic time. There were all these different parties. And instead of Hitler thinking, I need to form a big coalition, it's my understanding that he thought that more than one political party was ultimately a weakness, that for Germany to be strong, there needed to be one political party. It needed to be unified. And then that's when Trump started calling in the rhetoric for the 2024 election. Trump called Democrats who opposed him sick Marxists, who were the most dangerous enemies of the state. And when I think of fascist ideology, in fascist ideology, there can be no legitimate opposition. So all opposition becomes delegitimated.
Right. And that's one of the fundamentally anti-democracy aspects of it. So even when you say the part about Hitler wanting to, or having opinions about that Germany was weak with multiple parties and, would be stronger with one, even that I think is giving him too much credit, that there's a lot of this, and a lot of what fascism is a base human impulse of where these guys want to be in charge and they want to do whatever they want, whatever they feel like doing, and hurting whoever they don't like whenever they feel like it, and adding corruption, elements, pocketing money and getting rich and not having laws apply to them if they want. And so when people get in their way, they get angry and frustrated and lash out at them and try to crush them. And Whereas in a rule of law society, a democratic society, one that the United States had, you know, obviously with problems and with flaws, of course, that, you know, this is the whole idea of striving for a more perfect union, implying that it's not perfect already. And, you know, so a lot of flaws have to do with it, but where still had that principle of, with a democracy rule of law, like you lose a court case and you say, you know, okay, I appeal. And let's say you lose the appeal and you go, okay, well, that's what the judge ruled. And you go with it, as opposed to with the current government defying various court orders or claiming openly that judges on, for example, immigration can't tell the president what to do, by which they mean can't say that the White House has to follow the law and the Constitution, which of course it does. And that's why we have a judiciary. That's one of the major jobs of it. But they are rejecting that as well. And it's because of that same idea of nothing should stand in my way, that I should get to do whatever I want. And then other things like, oh, and this is for the best of the country. They might actually believe that or they might not. And even thinking of it as belief of is not quite right in the way that, say, you or I might think of national interest, that to them, the and this would be for fascists more broadly, the success of the nation and the success of themselves and their in-group to them are 100% the same thing. There is nothing separate from that. And that's why you can even see things like an argument of, you know, I'll just pick one example. Harvard is a crown jewel of the United States. It's something that gives U.S. immense amount of influence, not to mention, you know, economic success and so many other things. And but to the administration, it is somebody who is an institution that is not towing the party line, that is not bowing down when they said bow. And so they are working to damage it greatly. And if that hurts the country in the process, they really don't seem to care, or they don't think of things like a successful economy and successful diplomacy and a lot more influence around the world and stronger, you know, every other thing that we normally think of as national strength. They don't think of it that way. They're not approaching it in that way. And it's that different mindset that I think is hard for a lot of people to wrap their brain around, that why would you want to hurt the country? And the answer is because they think power for themselves is more important than anything, say, you or I would define as national interest.
Well, to kind of continue on some of the parallels with Nazi Germany, in the run-up to the election with regard to immigration, Trump said migrants were poisoning our blood and invading our country, setting up a war mentality and echoing the basic fascist theme of the existential necessity of preserving the blood and soil of the nation. And as Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf, all great cultures of the past perished only because the originally creative race died out from blood poisoning. At his Madison Square Garden election rally, Trump's followers chanted America for Americans only, echoing the slogan Germany for the Germans, foreigners out, which Hitler's followers chanted. So in line with America for Americans only, Trump argued that not just the criminal illegal immigrants need to go, but even the legal immigrants who he baselessly dehumanized by accusing them of eating dogs and cats.
Yes. And the scapegoat aspect, the scapegoat conspiracy theory, like the dogs and cats, which first, you know, I mean, it wasn't true and he was just saying it was made up. But then even the way that it was, in particular, then vice presidential candidate, now vice president J.D. Vance, pursued the story and then even admitted on television when pressed on it. OK, maybe it's not true, but, you know, we're going to keep saying it anyway, because then he goes to the market. That's the only way we get you to pay attention to, you know, something, something. And that would be a good example of the open rejection of truth, that the idea that, okay, so I might say, or, you know, you might say that, oh, if that was actually happening, that'd be a serious problem, but it's not happening. So we don't need to treat it as a problem. And in fact, treating it as a problem is being cruel to a bunch of innocent people who, you know, and everyone in their community is saying that they're, you know, valuable members of the community and they have legal status. And, you know, so what's the issue? We shouldn't be saying it. The Vance was openly arguing that the fact that it's not true doesn't matter. That's not actually a relevant criticism, that the fact that they are non-white people that he doesn't want around is the entirety of the argument. And so, yes, I think that the scapegoating of minorities, not exactly the same ones, though immigrants and non-whites and non-Christians are so similar, you know, but there's clearly more of an issue with Latino immigrants in the United States than there was in Nazi Germany in the 30s, you know, so different populations. But that idea of scapegoating a minority and treating it not as so immigration, not as an issue where reasonable people disagree about things like, say, the level of border security or how many asylees should be asylum applicants should be let in at any given time. All those are reasonable considerations, but they continue talking about them as migrants, as people, as human beings, which of course they are, as opposed to the dehumanizing language you mentioned. You know, the idea of blood and soil also then being the opposite of what the American conception of a nation and of citizenship was, that e pluribus unum, you know, out of many one, and the idea of American citizenship being something that people from around the world could come to and get. Or I think Ronald Reagan's famous speech about how the United States is like a shining city on the hill, and approaching immigration as, of course, people want to come here for America is so wonderful.
I think Reagan's last speech was making sure that we remembered the value of immigration.
Mm-hmm. And so you can't make a economic argument about it, because all the economists, or at least the vast majority of economists, are showing different ways that immigrants contribute to the economy. And you can't make a good national power argument about it. You can pretty much only make a racial argument about it. If the idea that the American nation should be kind of like some European nations, or like, say, what Hitler's conception of Germany was, that it is based on things like race, as opposed to based on the American idea, the freedom and democracy and those other lofty ideals that are the founding principles that we are striving for as a country, or at least up until recently were.
Now, in the run-up to the 2024 election, Trump claimed that elections were going to be rigged against him, that if he lost, there would likely be violence, and then the election targeted transgender people as dangerous predators, and then spread lies that schools were changing the genders of the students. And to me, this was all more of that kind of scapegoating, othering kind of language that a fascist would use, and that would also kind of predict violence.
Absolutely. And part of predicting violence is also threatening it. So there are ways to predict. I was concerned about the possibility of violence around election time, and I know many others were, but there's a way to raise concerns about, you know, the need for people to be able to vote, to exercise their rights without this fear of intimidation, and everybody should be able to, or other arguments along those lines. And then there is the scapegoating and the lying, and a fascist need. Another thing we see parallel between many different examples, you can add Pinochet in South America, also in Chile, that there's a need to always have an enemy, to have that the anger against an enemy, fighting against an enemy, of considering oneself a victim, no matter how comfortable one's life may be, but being constantly hopped up on that idea of, I am being victimized and I must do drastic measures, is a rationalization that is common among this type of politics.
Okay, so in the I became very alarmed that Trump, I just became very comfortable thinking that, yes, Trump is a fascist. There are a number of scholars whose work had helped me with that. Jason Stanley's work, how fascism works, Timothy Snyder, Robert Paxton. Mm-hmm. So I knew in my mind, I felt comfortable that, yes, this is what, if he gets elected, this is going to be horrible. And then I kind of convinced myself that he wasn't going to be elected, and then he was elected. And so the following morning after the election, all I could think of was a German minister named Martin Niemöller. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who wrote, first they came for the communists and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the socialists and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me and there was no one left to speak out for me. And so I began to think, okay, I'm in this moment now. This is the time. This is not the time. We are now my feeling was we are now legitimately in the first stage of fascism, kind of like stage one cancer. Like, you've got it. Okay. Stage one cancer is much better than stage four cancer. Stage one cancer is treatable oftentimes. So we're still in a moment where it's treatable, where we could potentially remove it. But before we can remove it, you have to understand that you have it. You have to believe, and you have to agree with the cancer diagnosis. You've got stage one cancer to go get it taken care of. If you resist the diagnosis, then you won't take the proper action. And so I felt I needed to do whatever I could to right now say, I think that what we are in is legitimately the first stage of fascism, stage one. And if left unchecked, it will continue all the way to stage four. If left unchecked, it's not going to stop itself. It is what it is.
This stuff never stops itself, and it never chooses to stop. Often it ends up burning out a lot of times because of the constant use of lies and the need to always praise the leader as wonderful no matter what, even when he quickly reverses and contradicts himself, makes for inefficient and kind of poor strategy. The constant need for enemies often can end up with them turning on each other, in part because if they manage to vanquish a lot of you, destroy institutions, or even just, you know, deport or kill off a lot of people. But I've been thinking about that poem a lot also, that, you know, it's something I grew up with, the First They Came For poem, and I think it's appropriate, which, you know, something that it is somewhat uncomfortable saying, because it does, if you actually mean it, then there are negative implications or like other things that then you might have to do. But if I could extend your cancer analogy, I think that we got our diagnosis, or I started making kind of that diagnosis argument in response to January 6th. And especially in Trump's fight with the legal system, and where he ultimately emerged victorious and with an assist from the Supreme Court, but where I was not held accountable for blatantly committing crimes and, you know, serious federal crimes, and managed to delay and avoid punishment for long enough to then get political power and stifle the investigations and kind of end that. And by that effectively ends rule of law in America. But so I, not entirely, but at the most significant, highest level. And so I agree with you, but I would say, even if anything, we had our cancer screening that said you have, you know, stage one, or you're at serious cancer risk. You're at the highest level of risk for lung cancer. Stop smoking. And the United States said, no, I don't want to, and lit up a bunch anyway.
Okay, congratulations. You've now convinced me that I'm at stage two fascism.
Stage two. So now, though, at one level, I'm going to partially disagree, which is in the, where you said with the diagnosis. So at one level, my answer to, you know, is it fascism, is yes. And then also, does calling it that really matter? And I'd say not really. So that the, I can give a lot of the intellectual influences and cite back, I don't know, fascist texts and different arguments. And you've given good examples of some of those, and where I find that useful, especially as a political science professor and thinking about it at that level. But at a popular politics level, the reason why fascism had such power, that word and label had such power for a long time, was because we all largely agreed that it was bad. And that has broken down. The, that is Nazi-like used to be a go-to. Okay, well then just about everybody thinks that's bad. Instead, what we have now is an overt example of, you have Elon Musk doing a Nazi salute, you're doing kind of a Heil Hitler, and some people react negatively, and then other people defend it, or some people dismiss it as a joke, or they make excuses for it, or they treat it as more normal. Or I could list a variety of the Hitler sympathizing, kind of openly Nazi sympathizing officials that are in the government now. And the so there is a possibility where people react to it thinking, oh, this is not exactly like Nazi Germany, certainly not the version that I've seen in the movies. And therefore, no, it's not, or that's exaggerated, I don't really need to worry about it. Whereas there can be debates then of what exactly constitutes fascism. But is this democratic or authoritarian? Is it legal or illegal, constitutional or unconstitutional, good or bad? Those are pretty easy and don't have the debates about, well, what exactly does this match up with in history? There it is, straightforward of, is the United States government operating under the Constitution? Only sort of, not really at the moment. And for the first time in, I'd say, my lifetime, except maybe a very brief window with Nixon that we closed really quickly.
Well, okay, so let me push back just a little bit, but then I'm going to push back on myself. Because I've kind of gone back and forth about the term fascism. On one hand, one of the things that fascism does is basically neutralize the meaning of language. So nothing means anything anymore. And so I want to retain, like, technically, I think that fascism is a valuable way to talk about an ideology that results in different kinds of political movements, but it's an ideology that's worth studying and understanding. And we need that word. It's an important word, even if we only use it in academic settings or formal diagnostic settings.
Sure.
I still think it's a very important word. And it's, I think that Jason Stanley's work, how fascism works, is really helpful, to understand it's more of an ideology that then expresses itself in political movements in different ways that are more or less successful. But that fascism as an ideology, with the rhetoric that goes with it, is incredibly it's incredibly dangerous, even at the rhetorical level. Mm-hmm. Because once people get all of that in their minds, they're going to start acting that out. So in my view, rhetoric is action. Language is action. And fascism cannot get underway in any form if there's not the ideology and the language that then goes with it. Now, let me push back against myself and then say that it might be more effective in the public domain to talk just about instability, the kind of economic and political instability that we're seeing right now is just unsustainable. That might resonate more with the average person than the actual term fascism.
Right. And I think that was one of the lessons of a harder lesson for me, but of the 2024 election, was that for a lot of voters, at least, or a lot of the public, are not paying that much close attention to politics, and arguments that are, and everyone has their preferences, what they spend time on, that things are then often arguments that are more abstract, that deal with vagaries of government, don't seem to resonate as much. How does this affect me, or the chaos, economic effects, potentially, violence or security effects, are perhaps better ways to connect with people. But I think we can do both at the same time. And on the thing you said, but about with the language and the rhetoric, I agree that that's important. I'd say broadly, this is part of an attack on truth, and that the argument that fascism is more an ideology, or for described as like an anti-politics, kind of a rejection of the we talk it out and use institutions like elections and courts to work out what we're going to do, as opposed to, say, a governing program, like in the way that the Soviets had, of, we're going to take over the economy and we're going to distribute wealth and any of the rest of that stuff with dictatorial communism. But I have a great quote, if you allow me. This is a Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, he calls this, it's about anti-Semites is the official quote, but I'm going to use fascist. It's the same meaning, but that really speaks to what you just said. I had this one called up of, never believe that fascists are completely unaware of the absurdity of their replies. They know that their remarks are frivolous, open to challenge, but they are amusing themselves, for it is their adversary who is obliged to use words responsibly, since he believes in words. The fascists have the right to play. They even like to play with discourse, for, by giving ridiculous reasons, they discredit the seriousness of their interlocutors. They delight in acting in bad faith, since they seek not to persuade by sound argument, but to intimidate and disconcert.
Well, that kind of leads to the attack against the universities, I think. Because university is a place where language is taken seriously and we're very committed to multiple perspectives. And J.D. Vance in 2021, when he was a candidate for the Ohio Senate, gave a keynote at the National Conservative Conference. And the title of the keynote was taken from a quote from Richard Nixon, "The universities are the enemy." And in that address, he said that higher education is a hostile institution that gives credibility to some of the most ridiculous ideas that exist in this country. if any of us wants to do the things we want to do, we have to honestly and aggressively attack the university. So here you are, a university, university professor. To me, this kind of all goes together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It all goes together. It's all part of the same thing. And a lot of it stems from that idea that we started with of they want to be able to do whatever they want, unconstrained by things like laws or morality. Also the belief of how power works in society and the role of conspiracy theories that a lot of this plays. So another element of this is a crowd has been arguing, influential kind of right-wing crowd, especially on the internet, has been arguing for a while that who is, say, the real power in society is people like universities and media organizations and HR departments. And for some reason in this conception, people like the president and the Supreme Court and business leaders and, you know, others don't have power, which is absurd. But on the basic idea that if they want to lie all the time and they want to break the law and hurt whoever whenever they feel like it, that the higher education system, the universities, are a counterweight to that, they're not wrong. And so a number of these folks, you can add Stephen Miller, the White House policy advisor, and a little below him of a activist named Chris Rufo, who did what amounted to a trial run of attacks on the university system in Florida. It was under Governor Ron DeSantis, but where they will, where this breaks out into more of the popular consciousness is with denunciations of wokeness and elites and changing acronyms. Have you heard it with critical race theory for a period of time? But a claim that these ideas, or when say Elon Musk talks about what he calls the woke mind virus, they argue and they do mean it quite seriously, that ideas that students are exposed to in universities and the people who graduate that and become, say, government experts that say things like, well, the evidence says this, and that doesn't fit with what you're saying, that those are in fact counterweights to them. And that their model is not so much Hitler in Germany, but is Viktor Orban in Hungary currently. So Hungary is a quintessential example of what political scientists call democratic backsliding, of where a leader gets elected legitimately, but then abuses their power in office and violates the law to remove things like checks and balances and rule of law, and to remove freedom of the press. And one of the biggest things that Orban did was go after what had been the highest ranked university in the country, and it shut down. So Hungary's higher education system is weaker. It has had negative effects on its economy, and yet it has crushed this societal counterweight to the ruling party's ability to consolidate power in the leader's inner circle and to be very harsh against migrants, against gay people, against a variety of other minorities, against Muslims. They consider that a good trade-off, that meaning both the current Hungarian government and the people in the United States who there's our current government that look up to them. And this is not just me saying, look at the parallels. They've cited this multiple times themselves. The CPAC, the big conservative political action conference, held a special session in Budapest. Then they had another one in the U.S. where Orban was the keynote speaker, and I think that one was in Dallas. Vance and others have cited him as an influence. They're quite open about this. And so the exploitation of conspiracy theories of where the people who are in this vision, the people who are really in charge of the country, are not, you know, not the government and not the police and not big business. And, none of those have any power. The people who are really in charge of everything are like the professors and liberal media and others. And so while that part is a conspiracy theory and is greatly overstated, their diagnosis of what is a counterweight to their power is not wrong. And that is why, in part, I think we're seeing I was always pretty negative about this, so I would say I'm not surprised too much by it, but more than many expected. I think a lot of people in the United States are surprised at the ferocity and the illegality and the extent of the attack on higher education, of both using accusations about anti-Semitism as a very obvious pretext of where they're not actually concerned about that, but think they have an in that they can use it, where they can get other people who have maybe some criticisms against higher education, you know, that did make sense within a normal way of operating, that were real criticisms, and use some of that. But mostly it's just try to destroy it. And why also things like, that's a lot of cancer research that you're getting. Like, do you really want to get rid of cancer research? And again, they don't seem to really care, because, or they think it's a worthwhile price, because then they can get more power, more control, and get rid of one of their, or potentially for their perspective, get rid of one of their cultural enemies.
Well, one of the things that the fascist agenda involves is creating a purified national myth. So it has to erase the histories of marginalized groups and mass movements that have risen up in their defense. So history has to be sterilized from anti-patriotic information. So as a part of patriotic education, children must be taught a sanitized history in which the state is presented in heroic fashion.
And also a very particular heroic fashion. So there are a number of Americans who I'd consider heroes, we think a lot of people would consider heroes, that don't fit into, but they fit into that national conception of America, you know, the land of the free type of conception of America, not of this blood and soil. Some people are real Americans, others don't count. So as an example of when in one of the purges that you can see of government reading material, education material, things on websites of where made an effort to, I think it was remove books about, I think it was Harriet Tubman, was one of them. I'd have to double check on that one, looking it up, but and getting rid of, it was Maya Angelou and Toni Morrison books from, I think it was like National War College or other public university, government connected universities. There's no particular reason, you know, why not to do that? Or there was one where they removed Jackie Robinson from, this was like a place of honor at, I'd have to look again. This one was recent. I'd have to Google it for you. But where then there was outrage and they brought him back in, or where they're closing the African American History Museum, that somebody like Jackie Robinson, I grew up thinking of as a hero. And for them to not, you know, to try to purge that, to get rid of it. Or just today saw news about how the Secretary of Defense is going to get a naval ship that was named after, he's trying to get a naval ship named after Harvey Milk of the gay activist in California of you know, politician, of get that removed. And or where they're trying to change the name back of some bases that had been named after Confederates, that why would any military have a base named after traitors as opposed to, you know, named after heroes? But that, oh no, they want to bring them back. So yes, they do have that idea, but it is much more of the conception of nation and of the history and what they consider heroic is bent around that racialized fascist ideal. It's not the traditional American conception, which includes people like, we have war heroes, you know, Washington and the rest, and, you know, up through, I don't know, other wars in World War II, of course. But we also consider people who did a lot to advance rights or stand up for the marginalized or help make America freer. We consider those people heroes. And part of this movement that we're dealing with is explicitly rejecting that, as recasting that, as opposed to heroism, as either outright negative, as damaging to the country in some manner, or at least as not worthy of veneration.
I'd like to read a quote from Jason Stanley's book. He says, according to fascist ideology, nature imposes hierarchies of power and dominance that are flatly inconsistent with the equality of respect presupposed by liberal democratic theory. Fascist ideology then takes advantage of a human tendency to organize society hierarchically. And fascist politicians represent the myths that legitimize their hierarchies as immutable facts. Their principal justification of hierarchy is nature itself. For the fascist, the principle of equality is a denial of natural law, which sets certain traditions, those of the more powerful, over others. The natural law allegedly places men over women and members of the chosen nation of the fascist over other groupings.
Yeah, that's right. That fits, though. Again, you know, I guess running theme of this, but where that sounds like it's a fancy rationalization for, I can do whatever I want, I'm going to reward my friends and hurt the people I don't like. And that, you know, I mean, granted, there's, you know, they can, yes, I guess, well, because this was traditional, but what does that mean? If it turned out that there were some traditions, and there are, that say that these specific people should not be in power, well, then they reject those, then those don't matter.
You know, it's not consistent. There's nothing consistent about it.
No. And if anything, I'd say what makes both fascism somewhat hard to grasp or understand is that because it so rejects that idea of consistency as having a value, as being something to strive for, that you want to be consistent and coherent. That's what most ideologies think, most political projects think. I'd say most people in regular arguments trying to understand the world think. But that is the thing, that is one of the things that fascists are rejecting, that they want to live in a fantasy world and one where lies have equal or sometimes greater value than truth. And so the idea that they are naturally traditionally supposed to be in charge and get to tell other people what to do, then any idea that says, no, they're not, even really basic, what do you think of core American ideas, the endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that the one you'll see this coming up on July 4th, I'm pretty sure this one's going to happen. Just reading the Declaration of Independence, in particular, reading the complaints that the founders wrote against King George III, show a shocking parallel to stuff that's going on currently. As one of the examples, one of the biggest complaints in the Declaration is that King George would arrest people or imprison them without trial, and would ship people outside the country without having done a trial first, so that they could then be imprisoned elsewhere, and there would not be recourse to get them back. And that's just one of the examples. But so the idea that you have an American president, an American movement that is standing opposed to the Declaration of Independence itself, that's not something that I really expected to happen. But it is that rejection of those values, because those values say that anybody can be an American, anybody can be in charge. And that means that they can't be in charge of everybody.
Well, when I was thinking about what I was concerned about, and with the trajectory of where things are happening, at least in the run-up to the election, I said that I was concerned that if Trump was elected, I think that there's a good chance that he will not leave office in any kind of regular way, that he will try to extend his term in some way, but that basically he is not committed to playing by the rules of American democracy, as imperfect as it is, he's not committed to any of those rules, really.
No, not at all. And if anything, I feel that even more strongly, that I've been operating under the assumption that this crowd is not going to leave power when they're supposed to legally. And if anything, I find it strangely naive that people don't think that. And the reason why is because we already saw them try once. That this is not speculation, that he was legally required to leave power in 2020 in early 2021, but after he lost the election, and tried many different things, including variety of lawbreaking, to stay in power. And then after his, you know, various schemes failed and various crimes failed and it didn't work, then yes, finally they, you know, slunk off in defeat temporarily and then proceeded to lie about the election a lot. But we already saw a large conspiracy to attempt to retain power, to lie about voter fraud, to get the Justice Department to lie and claim facts that didn't exist, to get states to overturn votes. Or Trump was caught on a recording with the Secretary of State of Georgia saying, could you just find me the exact number of votes that I would need to win the state that I lost? Or getting state legislatures to create fraudulent documents of fake electors and even sign them and try to submit them. Then eventually leading to saying that Vice President Mike Pence would single-handedly claim the power to decide an election, and which Pence thankfully did not do and honor the Constitution instead, but leading up to the violence of January 6th. So we saw that already. We saw them not leave power when they were supposed to. We saw that, unlike, say, for example, Hillary Clinton in 2016, she lost, and the next morning she gave a concession speech. And, you know, she was kind of bitter about it, obviously, and some Democrats were negative about it afterwards, but conceded. And then Obama, as the president, invited Trump to the White House and as president-elect and began the transition, as per always per the American tradition, much as George W. Bush did for Obama. Or, as a famous example, Bush's father, you know, Bush Sr., wrote this great letter to Bill Clinton that amounted to I really didn't want you to win, but now that you have, I support you and I want you to succeed for all of us. And here are some suggestions I have for you. And that was the way that we did it in this country. And so having seen Trump and his inner circle attempt a coup to cling to power after they were legally required to give it up last time, and then escape punishment for that coup attempt, and beat both impeachment and the legal system with the criminal justice system, which are the two main checks or main reasons for fear for various White House staffers not breaking the law, then why wouldn't they try it? So I can't say this is 100% guaranteed, but I would be genuinely surprised if they do not try to cling to power beyond these 4 years in some manner. It's hard to say exactly how things are going to develop between now and then, but in some manner, I will be surprised. And this is true even if Trump himself, you know, has a health episode and dies or is incapacitated. I expect some people around him to at least try to cling to power. And on top of that, all the additional incentives of they probably do have some fear, not unreasonably, and this is a problem for authoritarians worldwide, but that since they've committed so many crimes, that if they do lose power at any point, that they are going to be personally punished, as opposed to, which is just an additional incentive to try to cling to it. And given that they managed to re-get power, even get validated by a popular vote for the first time in any election he ran for, get that validation from the American people, why wouldn't they try? There's effectively no downside for them at this point and all upside. So I think it'd be really naive to expect that they wouldn't try to hold on to it in some manner.
Well, one of the things that has kind of, you mentioned internationally, the fascism internationally. And one of the things that has kind of helped me in this moment is to realize that this is not just something that's happening in America, that the same forces that are operating in America are operating at other places in the world. So if we could, I mean, we've been talking mainly about America. We did mention Viktor Orbán, but if you could kind of expand the lens a little bit and try to look at kind of an international assessment of where democracy is versus fascism and authoritarianism kind of in the world, and where we're sort of headed in the world. And I'll just sort of say that also with the rise of AI in the future, that seems to be kind of a boon for the fascists and authoritarians. If you're in power, as that AI moment comes or you can use it. I heard that one person said that that AI could result in almost an infinitely stable dictatorship. So could you talk just a little bit about all of that?
Sure. I'll do the AI one first, which is that at one level I think it was a bit with the constant dictatorship or like the stable dictatorship of there are people who dream of dictatorship that always say that, and it pretty much never works. And when it gets into the this is my part of the things that I teach about, that I teach national security, and I wrote a book about drones, and where so focus on a decent on insurgency, and they are just grossly overrating. It's pure sci-fi fantasy of the degree of control that they think with people, and to if things actually get there, to put a just really blunt point on it, server rooms blow up. And they need power, which blows up. And like, there's just, it's much more difficult to maintain these things in a sort of chaotic environment or where you have violent opposition and like a violent rebellion or something than a lot of people are envisioning. That said, the AI tools that exist currently, so we don't even need to get into sci-fi speculation about there's going to be some magic computer in a few years, of the tools that exist currently are a boon to fascists because it allows all that fake image creation and the fake quotes and things like deep fakes where you can make it seem like somebody is saying something different in a video or create images where it looks like some leaders are doing something or in response to we mentioned earlier with Trump's lie about the Haitian migrants in Ohio eating cats and dogs and J.D. Vance even admitting it's a lie. But you know what? Then a bunch of their internet fans use the AI image creation and they created images of Trump heroically rescuing some cats and dogs or just anything to kind of perpetuate that lie. And not only does it then help sell the lie for at least some people, I think more broadly, bigger concern is it aids in their not totally conscious, but a very concerted attack on truth. Attack on truth is a value. Because it's not just that they're creating fake imagery and that people can then latch onto it. Or another one that I find both very strange and that fits with traditional conceptions of fascism is the amount of fake imagery where they generate Trump, where he looks like he has a professional athlete or weightlifter's body. And where it's not enough for them to like his politics. They need to think that he is physically fit and sexually desirable also. And that is something you see throughout many fascist movements throughout the world, and both historically and more modern. And since you asked me, say, the world of where... excuse me. with fascism and say with the world, or maybe if we don't want to specifically say, you know, fascism, what we say as democratic backsliding of democracy globally is in its worst moment in many years, in decades, really. Say we probably have to go back at least since the end of the Cold War. It's probably a good way to mark it, where democracy had largely been on the rise. And starting in the mid 2010s with Trump's first election and the Brexit vote, and really before that, actually, Orban's first election and a few others, that we saw more of it rising worldwide. And so of the democratic backsliders, the ones where the ruler did get power legally via elections, and they still kind of go through the motions of elections, but they're not really free and fair. They're manipulated. The state has a pretty heavy thumb on the scale in its favor, and has also taken actions to do things like reduce rights, or help put leaders above the law. That I mentioned Orban in Hungary. There's Poland, though they partially reversed it with their last election. Turkey has been one of the quintessential examples of the Erdogan in Turkey has been in power almost this entire century. The one that was starting from a lower baseline, but is further along is Putin's Russia. Of that, Putin's first election was pretty much a fair election. And he has been in power all century. And that included, at this point with the war, of a crackdown where modern Russia is pretty close to being totalitarian. But very great, not quite North Korea, but...
Yeah, Gary Kasparov is now talking about the Putinization of America.
Mm-hmm. And a part of that is another, you know, model for it. I'd say Modi in India is another good example, and playing up a Hindu nationalism, and that includes scapegoating minorities. So in India, a big minority is Muslim, and that there has been violence against Muslims, both with some government kind of backing, but, you know, a lot of it of the perpetrators not being punished or really being investigated, and some encouragement from the government. I'd add Israel to this, including the efforts by the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to avoid corruption charges and effectively put him above the law and beyond the reach of courts to greatly reduce the power of courts.
And it kind of in conservative movements, both in Israel and the United States, have really latched on to these leaders.
Yes, very much so. And for a historical example, we don't always have to go abroad. Of a good example of democratic backsliding is in part of the United States, in the South, with the failure of Reconstruction and the imposition of Jim Crow. So where democracy and individual rights had moved forward in the aftermath of the Civil War and with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And then with local governments in a position of Jim Crow and the removal of federal efforts to force the defeated Confederate states to adhere to those amendments, then saw a considerable backsliding, and, you know, not nationally, not in the entire country, but with a number of people in the South, you know, especially Black people in the South, that had rights and then had them pulled back. And one of the honest things, though, about it now is not only do we see this in a number of different countries, Peru and Venezuela, actually two others I should mention. Venezuela is a good example of where it was the last leader, Hugo Chavez, that was elected and turned it into a dictatorship. And now his successor, Nicolas Maduro, even held did have an election, air quotes necessary, because it was very clearly rigged. Managed to retain power, because it's very hard to get people like this out once they're in. But another odd feature about this is there's an element of solidarity among them. There's like, it's almost like a fascist international of where, or transnational nationalism, which is sort of a weird thing when you think about it. It's a paradoxical, you know, how could that be? But where they are not necessarily all coordinating with each other. As I mentioned with Orban and Bolsonaro in Brazil, the last leader who had met with a number, came to the U.S. and met with even Trump officials or folks like Steve Bannon and Donald Trump Jr. and to help somewhat strategize when Bolsonaro attempted a similar type of what's called a self coup of, or an auto coup of not leaving power when legally required to. And one of the weirdest examples of this that I saw was where Putin often talks about like Western culture war things, the real minutia of I can't believe that he's saying this. So where one was he complained about J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter author, getting canceled. This was in a speech in Russian to people in Russia. Why is the president of Russia caring about this or about J.K. Rowling? Or when a Russian arms dealer, Victor Bont, got let out of U.S. prison in exchange for an American, there was Brittany Griner, the athlete that Russia had kidnapped and exchanged him. And then he did this interview with state media and they were asking him, what was it like in America? And one of his answers was like, they have 47 genders there now. Can you believe it? And I was thinking, this man's been in prison for 15 years. Why is this the thing that he's thinking about? And we could see this in the United States, too, of when Russia had released some military recruitment ads. And there were a number of Americans that were gushing with praise over it. And because the recruitment ad just had a guy who, buff looking guy doing some shirtless push-ups. And like, wow, that looked really tough. And this is just a literal recruitment ad for the Russian military. And you had folks like then at Fox News, Tucker Carlson talking about how great it was. Senator Ted Cruz was publicly saying, oh, look at how strong, this military is compared to our weak military. And the idea of a United States senator praising a Russian military recruitment ad and saying that the Russian military is stronger than the American military, American soldiers need to be more like Russian soldiers. That's absurd. I mean, both as a military analyst today, and you can see the Russians not performing militarily well in Ukraine, but anybody who lived through the Cold War, who has, seen any movie from that era of where, it was just so absurd. And they have this sort of culture war solidarity of opposition to including those forces of diversity and to higher education and to people other than them being in charge. And so have this kind of cross praise. And this even could go back to a lot of the Trump-Russia scandal or things with 2016 of the issue was never really that they did, collusion in the sense of we're constantly in contact and working out plans together. It was more what I would call convergence, that they share similar worldviews and they agree that it would be better for themselves if their counterpart were in power in another country. And so without coordinating, they sometimes put in some effort to kind of help boost the other in a way that is also selfish for themselves and weakens democracy worldwide, which is in their interest both globally, but also especially I'd say for domestic power for themselves.
How do you see Trump's tariff actions fitting into all of this?
So the tariffs are both two levels. One is, I think they're pretty clearly an abuse of power, that they're illegal and based on a lie. So what the law says is in the event of an economic emergency, and they're envisioning something like an oil blockade, in the event of a hostile economic emergency, the president gets special emergency powers to respond to this and to try to, say, end it. And Congress, in its wisdom, says that in the law, what it says is the person who declares when there's an emergency is the president. Technically, it's not officially illegal if you squint argument for it. And we'll have to see how the courts actually adjudicate this, that the recent decision that said that a lot of the tariffs are abusing this emergency authority will probably make it to the Supreme Court. And, then we'll see. That they often have found excuses to let him keep doing what he wants to do. A good parallel to that is the Muslim ban in the first term. As executive order stopped by a judge is unconstitutional, makes it to the Supreme Court, and they say, yes, it's unconstitutional because a couple of these small reasons. Then the administration just simply does another the next day. Lower court says, no, you can't do that. And the Supreme Court says, well, you got to leave it in place while we adjudicate it. That happens. Then this happens literally a second time, where then the Supreme Court eventually says, okay, it's not constitutional. So then the administration just does it again. And the Supreme Court says, oh, you got to leave that in place while we look at it. And eventually they're just like, okay, you dotted the right I's and crossed the right T's. We cannot technically say that this is not allowed. And so, but with that abuse of where a lot of this is clearly not a national security emergency. And this was in the Trump's first term too, that things like, I don't know, Canadian lumber, or for that matter, any Canadian, Canada has been a very close ally with the United States. Air Command, Air Defense of North America is joint. It's not just US, it's very much integrated with Canada. So no, like various Canadian economic products are not a national security emergency to the United States. That's utterly absurd. And that's also, so it's consolidating power in Justin himself, violating the law and using a lie to sustain it. And so that's, you know, one aspect of it where it fits. And then another is it facilitates a lot of corruption. So and helps consolidate power, that the tariff set up situations where people have to go to Trump personally and say, you know, oh, can you give me an exception to this? Oh, great leader. And yeah, I'll praise you publicly. Or what do you want in exchange? And I'll do that for you. Or just any different way you say nice things about me, you help me politically, help my political project. You slip me some money on the side, perhaps like, you know, via Trump's cryptocurrency, which is absurdly corrupt, or various other ways that people have been funneling him money. The way that, you know, the Saudis are like, we'll just grossly overpay to host a golf tournament at this place you own, you know, which is, again, just naked corruption. Or recently with a Qatar just saying, here, take this big, really expensive plane for free, just like out of the kindness of our hearts, you know, wink. So the tariffs really facilitate that, give a lot of opportunities for the president on a whim to say, you have an exception, you don't, or this is harsher against one of your competitors or against any particular country or anything like that. And then as a third element of the globally, it is a attack on the, and I don't know whether they fully understand it as such, but either way, whether they do or not, it is an attack on the post-World War II and especially post-Cold War global order, that the peace and prosperity that we have enjoyed, the unprecedented historically peace and prosperity, you know, relative, obviously there's still war and suffering, but less than there had been in the past in this period, that we have enjoyed is in part due to all the efforts to keep trade in the world open. One of the big causes of the Great Depression and therefore World War II was the response to the original crash at the start of the Great Depression, with then countries putting up tariffs and tons of tariffs. This was maybe the only tariff in history that American students learn about, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. And so these big tariffs, and every country does it, and that causes the global economy to worsen a lot faster and take a really long time to get out of it. And then you have the, you know, mass unemployment in places like Germany and Italy being a big contributor to World War II. After that, there was an immense amount of effort to let's not do that again. So there was the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, and that eventually grew into the World Trade Organization and various other leaders of various efforts by government and business leaders to make sure that trade stayed open. And so when the global financial crisis hit with the real estate bubble popping in 2008, you actually look at the numbers, the original crash, at least at its very beginning, is faster and harder than at the start of the Great Depression, at the great 1929 crash. It's actually faster and harder in 2008, but the world's leaders make a point of keeping trade open and citing the Great Depression. America's central bankers, Ben Bernanke had been a student of Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize winner, who won his Nobel Prize for studying the Great Depression and explaining how the Federal Reserve messed it up. And so they put a lot of effort, a lot of different people, to led by the United States, to keep trade open, keep it flowing. And the result was that the crash rebounded and the crisis was nowhere near as bad as the Great Depression ultimately, even though at the start it looked like it could have been. And so that's just one example of where the degree of trade and interaction between countries helps establish stronger relations. Or I can give you a specific example of this, that of the absurdity of it from the US perspective. American national perspective. When Trump had announced a number of these, what they called reciprocal tariffs, and that's also lying because it was not directly in response to other tariffs. But in these reciprocal tariffs, Vietnam was one of the first countries they jumped up and said, we'll do zero tariffs. And Vietnam has been an interestingly pro-American country for a bunch of the past years. That one is sort of an odd legacy of the war, and but a lot of it is fear of China. And so they've been afraid of China, and so they're very pro-American and have been throughout the 21st century. So they immediately say, we're going to do 0% on tariffs. And the response from the U.S. Treasury Secretary was, oh, we don't care about that. That's nothing. That's a trifle. And already Vietnam had very low tariffs, so because they aren't actually tariffing us. And they then, so Secretary of Treasury says, we need, we care about all the non-tariff cheating. And then the Vietnamese, or their response is, what are you talking about? You know, we're not cheating, because they're not. So there isn't something that they could give away. And then, so the US doesn't make a trade deal with Vietnam, even though they said, we'll get rid of any tariffs, if that's what you actually care about. And then the next week, Vietnam signed a supply and production agreement with China. So they had been resisting this for years and avoiding that sort of deal with China, right up until the point when America pushed them away, even when they tried to work with the United States. And so if there was a idea of, hey, let's all have a trade war with China, that, you know, look, I don't think that that was necessarily a good idea, but that's one of those things where it's policy. He won the election. Republicans won control of Congress. If they want to pass some big tariff, China tariff bill, that is, you know, that's how elections work, that is up to them. But if we're going to pick a big trade fight with China, the move would have been to rally all of our allies to do it together, and as opposed to pick a fight with everybody at once. And whether I don't actually doubt that that is all that strategic. A lot of it seems to be driven by impulse and by the self-aggrandizement and consolidating power and the corruption and the rest of that stuff. But it's also just very dumb strategy, and it makes it that people at both the trade level and add on top of this with threatening allies and not honoring alliance commitments and others at the international level, that countries can't really trust the United States, that even if this ends up working out okay, they will be afraid that this could happen. Something like this could happen any 4 years. You sign a trade deal with the United States, you spend years working it out, and what could happen? Well, you know, they could go and elect a president who breaks the law and says, I'm not following it, I don't care. And so that makes them a lot warier of entering into any of these long-term agreements with the U.S. And that is damaging both, that is for damaging for American power in the world, it's damaging for democracy in the world, and it's damaging for global stability.
Well, Dr. Grossman, I want to thank you for the time that you're spending with us today. If people want to hear more from you and access more of your work, where should they go?
So I'm active on Blue Sky and also on Threads. I run a site called Arc Digital, which is on Substack, just Arc Digital. If you Google it, you'll find it. And I write frequently for The Bulwark and now increasingly for MSNBC.com. One thing that I found is if you Google my name, you'll find me. There was briefly this period where there's a Finnish, I think Finnish or maybe Swedish soccer player, hockey player, whose name is Niklaus Grossman, but he spells it differently. Okay. And he beat me in Google for a while, but but at this point he's retired. And so he played in the NHL and now he's retired. So that helps. But I'm pretty easy to find if you look me up.
Well, as I said earlier, I don't want to be Martin Niemöller. And I wanted to say something, but I knew basically what I wanted to say, but I needed some help from qualified experts in the field. And I've heard you, and I was so excited when you responded and said that you'd be willing to have this conversation with me today. And I very much appreciate your work, and I wish you well. And if there's any way, I can help you in the future with your work, I would certainly love to do that. And best wishes to you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And thanks for having me. And I think, honestly, I feel like I need to caveat. I'm going to say something earnest. So I need to caveat it with, I don't know, that this is really earnest, but where I think what you said of exploring this and perhaps bringing some of these ideas to an audience that might not hear it otherwise, or might not consider it from this angle, is the sort of thing that really is making a valuable contribution, and that ultimately the way that we get out of this is that sort of thing multiplied throughout the country until enough people decide that this is not what they want and a constitutional democracy is more to their liking.
Well, thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us in this episode of Grace Saves All. You can help spread the word by sharing this podcast with others and by giving it a rating on iTunes. If you want to find out more about David, or if you'd like to leave him a message, go to his website, davidartman.net. In the meantime, let's work together to help a hurting world know about the greatest news ever announced.